Greetings and salutations. Welcome back to Life and Books and Everything. Hope you had a great summer as we get things started with a new fall season. I am Kevin DeYoung, senior pastor at Christ Covenant Church in Matthews, North Carolina. Good to have you listening or watching wherever you may be. Joined here with moderately special guests, Justin Taylor and Colin Hansen, to kick off the new season, get caught up on our summers and reading, and talk about various other and sundry matters. I do want to thank a couple of our sponsors at the get-go, Crossway and Desiring God. Desiring God, want to mention again the APJ, that's Ask Pastor John. So check out the podcast if you don't regularly listen to that. And the new book by Tony Ranke, 750 Bible Answers to Life's Most Important Questions, published by Crossway. It's an amazing synthesis, analysis of 2.3 million words. That's not how long the book is, you can be glad, of 10 years of these episodes. So it's, what do you want to know? What does John Piper think about thousands of things? And here's pulling hundreds of them into this book, Practical Application. So check that out. And a new book from Crossway, The Heart of Jesus by Dane Ortlund. Short, easy to read chapters, helpful explanations. A simplified edition of Gentle and Lowly takes readers into the depths of Christ's tender heart for sinners and sufferers. So check that out and sign up for crossway.org/plus, and you can get a discount and a Crossway Plus account. There we go. Colin, Justin, let's just start, because as we're recording this, it's the day after the Olympics, and at least in our house, we watched a lot of Olympics. If it was good, we'd watch it again in prime time. Good meaning the Americans won medals. I know we have an international audience, a huge international audience, so put up with the American-centric perspective here. But, you know, we did win 120-plus medals. So, Colin, you're a big Olympics guy? I mean, you watched a lot of the Olympics. Give us your Olympics take.
Watched a lot of Olympics. Family watched a lot of Olympics. I think my oldest or older son was especially addicted to the Olympics. We definitely had a strong preference for the Americans. However, we did have some allegiances to some of our ethnic connections.
Okay, so what people or countries, who are your, besides America, do you root for?
Norway and Denmark we also root for. So Denmark won the men's handball. Pretty proud of the Danes. However, I still don't understand handball.
No, it's like water polo.
I still don't understand.
You're just running around with a ball, throwing it in what?
And throwing it into the net. But hey, the Danes are really good at it. Also then with the Norwegians, followed very closely the running, especially the distance running with the Norwegians. And the last race won by Ingebrigtsen was especially interesting. I don't know if I'd say he's an especially likable character, but certainly a fairly standard Norwegian character.
No, I would put him as one that I most root against.
Yeah, exactly. But the Norwegians, I think the Norwegian personality tends to prefer lone ranger sports. Kind of fits
Karsten
the
Warholm, the terrain. He's got sort of that kind of like
yeah,
me against we the world
a
Viking
a big old
vibe.
Fjord-sized boulder on our shoulders, I think, there. So, but it was a pretty, I mean, it was exciting first to see him get beat by the Americans, you know, in the mile, right?
The 1500. Cole Hawker, very exciting. Best race, I think.
I think that was probably the highlight of the whole thing. Though, I mean, I'll let you, Kevin, you're the expert on the distance running especially. But I have to say, one of the coolest things of the whole thing was the American men's basketball team. It's always more interesting when it's competitive, and so much more interesting because it was in France, and both of the championship game, men and women against France, with a very partisan crowd, but also with a lot of American stars there. Very exciting. And that picture, there were two pictures, I think, from the Olympics. One of them from the surfing in Tahiti with the surfer pointing to God and flying in the air. That was amazing. And then the other of Steph Curry with Victor Wembanyama kind of flailing around trying to block his shot. those are some pretty enduring images from the Olympics. So those are two that will stick in my mind.
Justin, who do you root for when you're not rooting for the Americans?
I only root for Americans, so...
Good for you.
Yeah. And I'm just going to be terrible in this section because I did not watch a lot of the Olympics. I caught it more online, so I wasn't watching a lot of it prime time.
So you're not an American.
I root only for the Americans, unlike Colin. But one question I'm curious to turn back to you, Kevin. I think most of us watch the Olympics, and we're not really, you know, following gymnastics 12 months out of the year, and this is the culminating event. But for you, with track and field, I mean, you've gone to competitions, you follow this closely. What's it like as somebody really invested in the sport and then watching the Olympic trials?
I will say I would put my track and field fandom next to almost anyone. So I think I mentioned before, we did go. I took my two oldest boys to the World Championships when they were in Oregon in 2022, which was really cool. And we were, for that, we were literally in the front row for the 1500. We could have reached out and touched Jakob Ingebrigtsen, and we were there. It wasn't the final then, where Sydney set a world record there as well, but it was a prelim, and she ran right by, and I got a shot right on my phone of, you know, and track and field is so different, at least that the World Championships there were much less of a big deal than the Olympics, obviously. But when we went there, I tell people, it was like if you went to the NBA All-Star game and the NBA players just got up in the morning and played a pickup game of basketball in the park outside your hotel. Because you'd go on a run. Of course, everyone there is going on a run, and it's beautiful in Eugene. And you just see Olympians going on a run. I mean, it was very... It's just they're not superstars in the same way that, you know, an NBA player is. And you're right there. And so, you know, you'd ask, hey, Anna Hall, you know, would you sign this thing? And she didn't win a medal this time. So it was very exciting. In my family, we watch all the World Championships for track and field. We watch the Olympic trials. We watch the NCAA. We even watch Diamond League when we can. So to really know and you understand, that's a huge upset. I mean, Cole Hawker has been good for a long time, but a huge upset when he won the 1500. The guy Rooks, who medaled in the steeplechase, was like, no one ever heard of this guy. So until the 800, where Bryce Hopple, and we're losing all of our listeners now, a deep dive into track and field, but Bryce Hopple ran a time that would have been gold in Tokyo, and he got fourth. That was the only event, track event, that individual track event that the U.S. men did not medal in the whole Olympics was the 800. So they did extremely well. It was really fun to watch. Of course, Sydney McLaughlin, I guess McLaughlin Lavrone now, is great and sure seems like just a wonderful person and sincere Christian and really... And I was impressed. I told my wife, I said, you know, 3/4 of the athletes that they interview seem very well spoken and humble, and many of them give thanks to God and seem really happy and like. And then once in a while, someone would come on. You say, you know, the other fourth, that was one of those interviews right there. But 3/4 of them are just amazing. And I think and I want to ask you guys, you know, highs and lows, and Justin, you know, didn't watch too much of it, but it is one of those things, because it only happens every 4 years, you have some experience, like they zoomed in so close on Caleb Dressel, the swimmer, when he didn't do well, and you just see this guy's had as much success as anyone not named Michael Phelps in the pool, and yet he was disappointed, and I mean he's crying, and you're like, cut, just get the camera away. You have this you know, so you see these people in just exquisite moments of sadness, and yet what the Olympics is at its best is there are so many moments of exhilarating, pure, unadulterated joy in for family, for friends, for teammates, for everything that they've done. And whether you know the person or not, And guys, as we don't know most of these people personally or any of them, or we're even rooting for them, it is hard to watch and not feel, wow, that's good. I you know, sometimes people would say, I hope someone, sometime in your life, you have the experience of this kind of joy and just exhilarating happiness. And so the U.S. did great, especially in track and field. That was fun. My, of course, not surprisingly, I root for the Netherlands when I'm not rooting for the U.S. I really like Femke Bol. You know, even though she beat the Americans, she's great. Colin, what did you take away? Anything without doing too much of a Jesus juke here and, you know, gospel-centered Olympics watching? Just what did you like and take away from your many hours of Olympics binging?
Well, I saw somebody reference that they felt as though there was perhaps more testimony this time than they could recall in previous years. And it certainly felt like there was a little bit more joy. I have a feeling that the setting in Paris helped with that overall.
Especially coming out of Tokyo with no one.
Yeah, exactly. And previous Olympic Games and just other countries that are not nearly as familiar to Americans, for sure, and are harder to watch. Just thinking about having the families there. Mm-hmm. I didn't even think about that much, how they couldn't, not just the fans, but a lot of the families couldn't be there at all. So there was just a lot more joy that was just felt throughout the games, and it just felt really like a celebration. And so, to your point, it wasn't so much about the agony of defeat, to go back to the old ABC Wild World of Sports. Right. There were moments like that. But those moments were even more poignant because of how exceptional they were. So, for example, I'm just thinking about the producers for the Women's Basketball Championship on Sunday. The story was not the United States winning. They never lose. The story was France. And you could see that the French women were just devastated by the loss. I mean, all of them with mascara and everything smeared all over their faces. They were weeping. They were so sad about it. That would have been one of those reverse 1980 moments,
right?
For the American women to be defeated there. But there were so many. I mean, the Olympics are only 2 weeks, but they simultaneously feel very short, but also very long. So going all the way back to, I mean, the women's rugby final,
and that was crazy ending.
The equivalent of you're down a touchdown and you need a 99 yard run to be able to win the game, and that's exactly what happened.
The miracle at Jordan Hare. Sorry to bring it up.
well, you know that. Let's not get carried away here.
Yeah.
But that was amazing, and once again, just evident joy from so many of those athletes. And I think probably a lot of the people, I mean, most prominently in the United States, would be thinking about the women's gymnastics. Gymnastics was fairly early, so it's easy to forget. But a lot of the way that the teammates celebrated each other, the American women celebrated other competitors, especially the woman from Brazil, who was absolutely amazing and has overcome so much to be in that position. And if Simone Biles didn't exist or hadn't come back,
it would be Andrade is the greatest gymnast in the world, yeah.
Oh, and she does, and then clearly Simone could see that and went out of her way to be able to honor her in that setting. And then who can forget Pommel Horse Guy? I mean, that was such a cool random occurrence of watching that. I'm thinking about my daughter who says, oh, I could do that. My daughter has unbounded confidence in herself. I'm like, no, I don't think you could. The pommel horse guy did make it look easy. And just sitting there kind of in the zone and taking off those glasses he can't even see.
God made me for a purpose. And when I pommel horse, I feel his pleasure.
Well, and to your point, Kevin, just bringing it back, a lot of the, more so than in American professional sports or even college sports in some way, especially the revenue ones, basketball, football, and professional baseball, it's easier to relate to these athletes because they're not as famous and they're not as special. And pommel horse guy will be pommel horse guy for the rest of his life while he's off doing something like accounting. Who knows what he studied at Penn State there. So that's what I took away.
That's good. I would be remiss if I didn't indulge in some airing of grievances, however. Justin, are there any Olympics grievances amidst all, just to not revel in the joy theme alone? Because I have several, for as much as I love the Olympics, but I'll give you the first.
Is this the breaking portion?
Oh, we are going to talk about breaking, which, I will save that. Justin, would you like to get us started?
I will yield my time to the gentleman from North Carolina. And other than the opening ceremonies, there weren't many grievances that I was cataloging.
Okay, I have a few. We're not even, obviously, the opening ceremonies in the one part in particular was blasphemous. All right, a lot has been said about that. It was terrible. So, one, too many sports. Okay, I'm not knocking if this is your thing and you do it and have a championship for it, but too many sports. Breaking, again, these may be the best people in the world, break dancing, but it's not break dancing, it's breaking. But man, that looked silly. And, you know,
are you talking about the good stuff or just the Australian?
Well, the Australian, that was something. Well, there are a lot of sports, I have to be honest, that, you know, I'll think to myself, like, how many more foil things do we need? And then the Americans will win a couple goals. I'm like, that is one of the most important sports in the world. We ought to have more of
but
that.
But not diving.
Okay, because, so number two.
Okay, here we go.
Grievance. Why is diving in prime time every night? Now, this is not when we grew up and Greg Louganis was winning gold medals. Okay, the U.S., again, if you are listening and you're passionate about diving, okay, but we're not at a real good at this right now. China won every single gold. It's not the most exciting sport. I get it. I wish they would show triathlon in prime time, but they don't. I understand. You can't have everything. So I don't understand why so much diving in prime time. Okay, you can't do just swimming and track the whole time, but if you need filler, you know, give us another sport that we don't care about. Can we see badminton? Can we see? Well, China won all the ping pong medals too. I mean, what else can we see that we don't normally get to see? Can we see some surfing? So diving, Colin, do you understand why is diving in prime time?
I really think it's because there were a lot of decisions that are made because of the audience that it's playing to. I mean, I don't know why Flava Flav was there. I don't know what was
why
happening.
I was about to become Lutheran and believe in the ubiquity of the body because Snoop Dogg was everywhere. Why did he become the mascot for the United States? Is it because he's doing The Voice or something? Was this all like a lead-in to NBC programming?
I do think that 4 years ago, NBC stumbled on this weird ESPN The Ocho treatment of some of the games, especially with the horse dancing.
Yeah.
And I think when they took Snoop Dogg and put him with Martha Stewart and had them comment on the horse dancing, I think they were like, hey, we just made dressage a thing, and so we're going to come back with that. So I think, but I mean, but he did seem to be basically spreading a lot of joy,
yeah,
as we're talking about.
No,
people seemed to get into it. So I didn't
despise. It was just a puzzle. It was just puzzling.
It was puzzling, and again, the ubiquity. But going back to the diving, I think it's just because, you know, bozos like me stuffing potato chips on our couch can say, that was terrible. That was a big splash.
Oh, big splash.
Boo, big splash. I think it's because it's very simple to judge.
Very simple. Just
from the couch.
And they can splice it all together.
And it is horrifying to imagine. I mean, imagine standing up on top of that platform. Oh, that would be so scary. So I guess that's why they put it there. But, you know, again, it's probably the Nordic part of
me. Were you asking us to imagine you standing up on that platform?
No, please don't.
No one wants to imagine any of that. But it's kind of like thinking about ski jumping. You're like, that is so terrifying to imagine. So there could be some of that.
Okay, here's just the last part. This is the jingoistic part of my rant. So when I'm in America, I anticipate if you're watching in some other country, and you can let us know, our global audience, what it's like in your country. But if I'm watching in America, I want it focused on Americans. Okay, good. Leon Marchand did great. He seems like a nice guy. Happy for him in France. No qualms, but I don't want his swim to be the NBC swim of the night. I don't know. Correct me out there in France. Are you guys all going gaga for Katie Ledecky? It's like, everyone, come. Katie Ledecky is swimming. She's going to win another medal for the Americans. I know greatness has its own attraction, but I want to know what America is going to do. Here's my other thing, okay? I would love to hear, because I've never watched the Olympics from another country. We have, on the NBC coverage, lots of... So Lee Diffie does track and field. He's a really good announcer. He's Australian. Who's the lady? Rebecca Lowe, is that her name? Who does like the morning stuff on NBC? She's British. So there's lots of Brits and Australians who are announcing. Again, I love both. Okay, love you, Christians.
Are you
there.
Lobbying, Kevin?
No, I'm just. Here's what I'm saying.
Is this your application?
I'm just. Do any other countries in Britain? Do you have a lot of Americans announcing your sports for the Olympics? Okay, I'm not. They do a good job. This is not, you know, cultural prejudice. Just saying, when we're rooting for, I want to know for sure. What I would love to hear is someone who maybe sounds like Larry the Cable Guy doing some play-by-play in Britain. I would just like to see. I'm just guessing they don't do that. So there's my jingoistic rant. I just want to be all in, all the time, America to win.
I feel that the slight need to balance here.
Okay.
The BBC did an amazing recap of the Olympics that was focused on the families. And like with old home videos of the different Olympians and features on their parents and things like that. But then they also interspliced all these other things like Simone Biles and other athletes and things like that. If anybody wants to go out there and shed some tears, go ahead and check out that part of the BBC. Though I also do think that it's kind of like watching soccer. If you're an American, you kind of expect a British announcer.
Okay, I get it. For sports that aren't our sports, you made up the sport. We don't quite know how to play it. That's fine.
But track and field, if all the athletes from around the country, around the world, are all competing in the SEC, then we want an SEC sounding announcer for track and field.
Yeah, well, that's okay. That was another. Most of these people, don't get me started. Mondo Duplantis, he's an American. He's an American. Okay, I'm happy. Sweden, good, happy for you, but. The guy was born in Louisiana. So what did somebody tweet? If you've ever been to an all-you-eat Bojangles, you're an American.
Did you see how he compared it to a Death Valley on a Saturday night?
Yeah.
So that's what it was like in there. By the way, Kevin, you should watch the feature on Ingebrigtsen and his dad.
Okay.
That was worth it in there. It's pretty darn sad.
Yeah.
But that was kind of the flip side.
Whenever they
things.
Do the backstories... I start, can we just get to the event? Who is this for? And then my wife will say, wait, turn it up. I want to hear. And I'm like, oh, that's right. I'm not the only one watching. That's who this is for. So, yes, so you're a better person than I am, Colin. You want to hear the backstory. All right.
Only on that one, because it was Norway, and it was about his dad, why he's good, but also why he hates his dad.
Well, that
so
is.
So it was pretty compelling.
Yeah. That is sad. All right, Justin, and you want to wrap us up here? Anything about Huskers football? We've lost all of our listeners.
Yeah, where are we on recruiting?
All I can say is I'm ready for Husker football. August 31st, we're into college football season now, the month of college football. We won't bore our listeners with going through all our predictions of our intra-Big Ten rivalry, but if you are a Nebraska fan and you have had 7 seasons without a bowl appearance, the offseason is very, very long. So I'm glad college football is back. Almost back.
Justin, did you add books behind you? Do you have a lot more books now in your setup?
No, you look smarter.
Thank you. I've got my Lincoln collection right over my shoulder here. So just trying to impress you guys.
I am impressed. It worked.
When Steph Curry, and those were an amazing last 2 minutes of the game, when he went very Steph Curry, hit those four threes. The last one was ridiculous. Nobody should have shot that, but it went in. And I say to all my family, like, and you guys know he played at Charlotte Christian? And my whole family's like, Dad, that's like the one thing everyone in Charlotte knows. Why are you telling us this? Like, we didn't know. And then shout out to Anna Cockrell, who won silver behind Sydney in the 400. She ran at Providence Day. That's also, so these are two schools in the same conference with our little old Covenant Day. I was asking my kids, if Covenant Day is going to have an Olympian, what sport is that going to be in? Probably not track. They thought maybe a field hockey or something. What would you guys, okay, last Olympics, well, here's a question. If you wanted to be a bad parent with your kid and you saw some just baseline athletic ability, nothing off the charts, but, you know, better than average, and the goal was to get this child in the Olympics from America, what sport would you pick that you think would give them the best chance of making it? Because you're not going to try, you're not going to do the 100 meters. That's like the last thing you're going to do. You got to be one of the 8 fastest people on the planet. I don't think that's coming from Colin, Justin, or Kevin. Would you do the shooting guy from Turkey? Would you just say, go hard at ping pong? I'm thinking probably stay away from the things that the Chinese Communist Party can support. What would you do?
Probably pommel horse.
Good pommel horse.
You just need something you can put in the bedroom, and you don't need to travel. You don't need to, just a one-time investment.
Pommel horse, there it is. Colin?
One-time investment.
Yep.
I did start my son on shot put. It does seem kind of competitive and largely dependent on size, but he's well on his way. So we're going to ride shot put as long as we can. We'll see how it goes.
Ryan Krauser is amazing. Just get out of bed. Just, all right, I could throw this farther than anyone ever in history. One throw, that'll be it. Yep. Those are some big dudes. Okay. What else? Life, books, and everything, and the Olympics. We'll just add that to the moniker.
Once every 4 years.
Yeah.
Only every 4 years.
Yeah, guys, so you could put up with 25 minutes. Well, Winter Olympics, but U.S. isn't as good at Winter Olympics. Then it really is Norway.
True. The riveting of long haul skiing.
Yeah.
Oh, goodness, cross-country
skiing. That's how they get around, right? Do they just ski in between towns still?
Or down the mountains.
Yeah, down the mountains. Okay, give me one book. And if you can remember, try to do something different than we talked about at the beginning of the summer. It could be a book. I'll even let you a book you listened to or read. Give me one thing you read over the summer that you really enjoyed. Justin?
If we're going with just one, Adam Goodhart, 1861, on the start of the Civil War. I know I'm always on a Civil War kick, but I've listened to Eric Larson's Demon of Unrest, which is on start of the Civil War, and read on vacation Adam Goodhart's book, and I tweeted that I think it's one of the best history books I've ever read in terms of a historical narrative. Just really compelling, really interesting, zooms in on various characters, knows how to paint a scene, good pacing, learn new things. So I'm kind of in awe of his achievement with that book.
That's really good.
Justin, I want to follow up on that one. So, and I think we may be talking about writing here as well, mm-hmm. So I'm kind of getting a jump on that. With history, I've noticed that you can make a couple errors. You can stay too elevated with history, or you can be too granular. How does he handle that difference between focusing on a character or focusing on kind of getting down to the details, but keeping you within the broader story?
Yeah, I think one of the things I thought was really fascinating was his ability to zoom in. So, you know, he discovers that there's a judge in Washington, D.C. who is selling his slave at the end of his life. And then he zooms in on, you know, who was this slave and what sort of things did he do in Washington, D.C.? And wasn't slavery outlawed in Washington, D.C.? And all of those sort of things. So that that combination of giving you big picture and keeping the narrative going, but knowing when to take the camera and kind of zoom in on a particular person's life and background and history. Not sure exactly how he did it, but he somehow pulled it off in a really interesting and compelling way, at least for me.
It's great. And we will circle back to writing in just a moment. The big book that I read, I hadn't mentioned earlier, which was really fun for me, and I'm really playing to type here, but I read the big autobiography of Ashbel Green, which is like 600 pages. Somebody should, and I just have an edition that is just Google Books kind of print on demand. So this came out in 1849. Ashbel Green was a protege of John Witherspoon, hence my interest. I skimmed through this big book when I was doing my Witherspoon stuff just to kind of glean where he talks about Witherspoon, because he was the one who edited Witherspoon's collected works and wrote a biography. But Ashbel Green was a very important Presbyterian pastor in his own right. And this is like 500 pages of his autobiography, and then it just stops, and then it's like 100 pages of other people's recollections of Ashbel Green. So he's a pastor in Philadelphia. Then he was president at Princeton for 10 or 11 years, early 1800s. He was instrumental in the founding of Princeton Seminary. He probably literally served on every Presbyterian board and agency. He helped start the American Bible Society. He fought in the Revolutionary War and saw action. He really lived, especially if you're into Presbyterian history, a really fascinating life. And I love reading about pastors. And he, what made it interesting is he's a very strong personality. So the recollections of him at the end all say something like, though his public demeanor was often repulsive, in private, he was a wonderful, warm-hearted Christian. So he just had...
So Twitter? Yeah, Twitter before, right, yeah. Twitter, apparently.
He was... His reputation during those conflicts in the Presbyterian Church was very much of an old-school, you know, hardliner, but... You know, he's one of our guys, my guys, I would say. But he had that reputation. So he made a lot of strong allies and strong opponents. And yet was, I mean, they're just it's a different time. I mean, he talks about, he doesn't, it's like, I don't think, and he's not saying this pridefully, I can recall ever missing family worship except when I was desperately sick. It's like, ugh. You know, the fastidiousness which an earlier generation kept the Sabbath, did family worship, were constantly agonizing over their heart and their soul. And he's really fascinating because he had melancholy, depressive, we would almost say manic. He had this experience where he said, I felt as if I was a sheet of glass and I could be broken at any moment. I mean, almost kind of like a bipolar, almost sort of experiences that he had, and he could be extremely frank in his assessment. So he said he went to meet Witherspoon's second wife. Witherspoon remarried when he was 68 and his wife was 24, which even back then was pretty scandalous. And Ashbel Green says, she has a reputation for being handsome, and I did find her quite comely and not much else. Like, he tells a story about shaking hands with a woman after church who had the, quote, most fetid breath I have ever encountered. So that went down to my very bones. He was fearful of the yellow fever. So anyways, just a lot of, you know, Ashbel Green laid the cornerstone for 10th Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia. So he's just a guy who was around for a lot of important things in American history and Presbyterian history. And so I've been on an Ashbel Green kick, and reading this big book was fun for me. What about you, Colin?
So a good book, I think, is especially one that you can remember where you were when you read it. You can remember the setting, thinking about the book, you can go back to that place. Well, one of the books that I packed when I was back in South Dakota for the 4th of July, it's actually a self-published novel. That's not normally a good sign, but a self-published novel called Theo of Golden by Alan Levi. Alan's got a mutual friend of mine who handed me not one but two copies of the book, including one that was signed by the author and personalized. And I didn't think much of it, again, because, you know, all three of us, we get a lot of books, publishers, and we're reading a lot of books and we're engaging with a lot of books. And I don't read a ton of Christian novels. It's not something against it. It's just, if I'm reading those, they're typically in the past. And so contemporary fiction I hadn't thought of, but I picked up the book and it was incredibly encouraging. And if you look on Goodreads or you look on Amazon, you can see the book is something of a phenomenon now. And I mean, it's been very popular, been very successful, and it made me want to know more. It was just very encouraging. It's a good story. It's kind of realistic in some sense, but also kind of takes you into a different world at the same time, which is great. And it's just built around this mysterious character who goes around doing good, and you don't kind of find out why it all comes together until the end. So, Theo of Golden by Alan Levi. So some good contemporary fiction.
Online, on
anywhere,
Amazon.
Yeah, Amazon, everything. Yes, yeah, so you can see already there. He's got 706 ratings, 4.8 rating on Amazon and Goodreads. He's got 815 ratings of 4.73. So you can see, it's the kind of book where it's not going to be everybody's cup of tea, but a lot of people are really passionate.
What's
about
the setting?
The setting is small town South. So basically where Alan is from, it's Columbus, Georgia is what he's writing about, but it's not named Columbus. But basically this guy shows up, goes around doing a lot of good. You're not exactly sure why he's doing that good. And it kind of builds toward a very compelling climax and very dramatic, and then a lot of big reveals in the end. But the whole journey to get there is really encouraging too, just the way that he interacts with people. I found it compelling. Again, anybody can read this book. It could be high, it could be low. It actually is, it's a novel, so it's a little bit quicker, but engaging a lot of high-level artistic ideas and philosophical ideas as well. So it's a good book, Theo of Golden.
My wife has often appreciated your fiction recommendations. She loves The Gentleman in Moscow. Now, before you, I think, though, she read Kristin Lavrin's Daughter.
Oh, yes.
Years ago. And okay. She kept telling me about it. Like, why are you reading this? But it's one of the great. So I haven't. I'm not as literate as you and are.
I just started picking up that author, Sigrid Undset's, another trilogy. So I started that one called The Axe. So we'll see if it lives up.
I'm doing something for the first time in pastoral ministry, and that is that for our staff book, so I've done this for 20 years in both churches. I've been the senior pastor. Senior staff will meet every other week and go through a book. It's time for learning, but it's also time for laughing and conversation. So our last book, we did Digital Liturgies, which was really one of the people loved it. So thank you, Samuel, and thank you, Crossway. Before that, we did Lloyd-Jones' Spiritual Depression, which they really liked. I picked some clunkers along the way. I love G.K. Chesterton, Everlasting Man. Most of my staff did not. So I don't bat 1,000. But for the first time, I am picking a fiction book. So we're going to read Till We Have Faces by C.S. Lewis, which is maybe his most difficult fiction work. No. And so we'll see how that goes. Have you guys both read that before?
It's later fiction of his, right?
Yeah, yeah. One of his.
Comes after Joy.
Yeah, she was instrumental in the writing of it.
I for a long-term writing project, I'm working on something with Churchill and Lewis, and I was just reading McGrath about that book, but I haven't read it yet, so I'll add it to my list.
Yeah, I read it years ago. It's not the easiest, but some people say it's his, you know, most mature, brilliant piece of fiction, but it's the retelling of Greek mythology. Anyways,
I have not read it. Kevin, have you read Gilead by Robinson? I don't know if I've ever asked you, and it seems like you might not like it, but maybe you do.
I've heard so many people recommend it, and I gave it a take, and it wasn't my cup of tea. But that could be me. Same thing with Wendell Berry. I know I'm a bad person. I wasn't my cup of tea.
I think one thing that is challenging when you're going back and forth between fiction and nonfiction is you have to understand that nonfiction tries to sell you on a thesis mm-hmm. up front and then works to defend it. Fiction is the complete opposite. It builds toward. You have to basically invest in it. And yeah, they kind of try to grab your attention, but it's really meant to build toward something in the end, usually. Gentleman in Moscow is a good example of that. Very dramatic end scenes. But the rest of it is very mundane, and you kind of get some more of the backstory as you build into it. I wouldn't say that about Gilead. Gilead is just a constant slow burn.
Yeah.
But you really have to have a Midwestern sensibility in some ways to be able to make it work. But you also might have been caught up a little bit, Kevin, with the fact that as a Presbyterian, he probably would not have been one of your guys.
No.
to your earlier point.
I have sometimes... Yeah, I totally admit it's me. I should do more. I mean, I'm always impressed, Colin. You read a lot of fiction. I mean, some things work with me. I loved P.G. Woodhouse and read all the Jeeves and Wooster, so that's great fun. Someone recommended years ago The Book of the Dun Cow by Walter Weingren, which I really loved. I told my family to read it, and they're like, "This is weird. Why did you like this book so much?" I do about one or two fiction books a year, and I'm probably worse because of it, but I try. Speaking of writing, narrative, story, let's transition here for the last minutes we have. Both of you guys have written a lot, are very good writers. Colin has written, you can see above his shoulder if you're watching, the book on Tim Keller. Oh, there it is. Did I write that? And Justin, I think you've mentioned before, are you at liberty to say more about the big writing project you've been engaged in for over 10 years?
I think that was a big reveal last episode. Yeah. Surprise big reveal.
Yeah, it just flooded the airwaves with comments about that. It was a huge deal.
Twitter blew up.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't know how much more I need to say, but I've been working on it for over a decade and have written probably a million words and need to pare things back.
What is
a
it?
Lot. A biography of John Piper. So we've, I've been laboring on that and have been working on it for years, have years to go before I complete it, and going about it in probably the most inefficient way that anyone has ever written a biography in the history of man.
And what is that?
Trying to do a sort of a massive version that covers everything and then pair it back to a coherent narrative. I didn't count the cost when I started it, but I think I see a way to finish it.
Will you finish it in 10 years? Is that the goal? Another 10?
I don't know.
Sooner?
I'd like to be sooner than that, but in some ways it depends on how much I can do and how quickly I can go. But I think I have a clearer way now of how to proceed. But in terms of kind of mapping out a timeline, that's a little bit more difficult.
Justin, you've given me some good recommendations. I can't remember the specific titles off the top of my head, but a great courses series of lectures about writing. I forget the name of the guy who did that, but that was more writing fiction,
right.
But very helpful in thinking about even writing nonfiction. And then this book, and you'll remember the name of it, but I've been listening to it, and it's really excellent on writing narrative nonfiction. So tell us about both of those and some of the things you've learned about how to write narrative in particular.
Yeah, the book you're referring to is Jack Hart, H-A-R-T, book Storycraft, which is all one word. And I think it's the best book out there. Not that I've read all the books, but just enormously helpful in thinking about how to tell a story. The narrative arc and the tension and introducing characters. And he was a writing coach and a longtime editor, mainly for journalists. So if you're thinking about writing a 700-page biography like I am, it may be, you may have to adjust the expectations or the counsel. But he just thinks through what do you need to do to keep the story moving, to give them a picture in their mind. So it's not just about telling facts, but we're story oriented. We like characters who are rounded characters who have some depth to them, some interest, some commonality, some differentiation. We like conflict. We like redemption. So in some sense, you know, there's different elements of writing. There as those like the three of us who are oriented towards history, we want to tell the facts. You know, so and so was born in a certain year, and you can't make that up. You can't fudge. You can't estimate. You have to say what year he was born and where he went to school and when he got married and what he wrote and the like. But just a recitation of facts is helpful, but it's not that interesting. So how do you tell somebody else's story? And one of the things I'm discovering working on Piper, which is obvious, but when you really get into it, you could do a 300-page book about 1 month in somebody's life. And for somebody who hasn't written that much, that might sound like, man, could you really write 300 pages? You really, really could. So how do you take 80 years of a life, 90 years of a life, and put it into something that doesn't get into the minutia of what did they eat for lunch when they were 24 years old? So there's a grammatical punctuation, how the English language works aspect to writing. There's a research of getting your facts right. And then there's how do you tell a story in a clear and compelling way that keeps people's interest and isn't superficial and doesn't get lost into the weeds and keeps the narrative moving.
Yeah, because you can, like you were saying earlier, Colin, you can write either fiction, or let's just stick with narrative nonfiction, and describe every leaf on the tree. And you know, I don't like that kind of writing. I want to know the characters. I want the story to keep moving. And maybe somebody says, well, you need to know what the tree looks like. Well, only if it's important to understand the story. So you can give too much information, or you can just give not nearly enough, and you don't really know. Why do I care what this person is like? Why am I interested? One of the things I noticed, like reading Ashbel Green and reading biographies and autobiographies from an earlier century, is they always included detailed descriptions of what someone looked like, which we don't do anymore because we assume, well, you can see a picture. You probably didn't have to describe what Tim Keller looked like because his picture is on the cover. But these people, they may have never seen this person. So there's lots of descriptions. Yeah. And that helps you to know. But too much is a burden, too little, and you can't get invested. And one of the challenges with history, I've been working on a church history thing, is unlike, say, exegesis or theology or Christian living, which is normally what I do, get the idea in your head, understand it, and then help explain it and teach it and tell an illustration. It's much more, I find it much easier. It's getting stuff in my head, and then how do I get it out in a way? History, I have to think, well, I can't say it was a bright sunny day if I don't know it was a bright sunny day. I can't say he was fearful if I don't have some good inference or indication he was fearful. So it can be painstaking to keep having to check, well, was this really what happened? Do I have the facts? Colin, you're as a good writer, it can seem kind of effortless, but I'm sure it's not. What was the process like with Keller? How do you think about it? Was journalism at Northwestern really helpful? It seems like it probably was. Yeah. How do you think about the craft of writing, story in particular?
I was thinking about what you guys said there about how much do you say, how much do you not say. And Andrew Roberts, I just read for the second time through his 1,000-page Churchill biography. That was, I looked back and thought, I thought I read more this summer. Oh, I did. Andrew Roberts again. And that is an extremely selective
for Churchill.
1,000 pages. I mean, it's just kind of skimming the surface on stuff. Now, with some figures like Churchill, he wrote millions and millions and millions of words like Piper. And his life was very dramatic at various different points, even more so than Piper's was. But that is one of the big challenges of figuring out when to, and that is a journalistic thing, when to zoom in and really take people and help them to feel, engage their senses, to know what this is like. So for me with Keller, I was trying to think about, when does it matter that I do that and when does it not matter that I do that? So for example, I thought, I want to give people a sense of Bucknell University, but I don't feel as though I have to go in depth on exactly what this small town in Pennsylvania is like. However, I really wanted to go in depth and detail on what it was like to be in New York City on 9/11, because I wanted people to understand Tim's mental sort of and spiritual framework that would lead up to that famous sermon on Sunday. In part, I also wanted to engage a little bit of what I'd learned from reading a lot of Tolstoy. Tolstoy is famous for talking about, you know, war and peace, it's all these major events, but really, it's not how we experience those events. We experience those events in very mundane ways. And so, for example, whenever I talked to Tim and Kathy about 9/11, they would always talk about their son, who had broken his leg, and how they were trying to take him to surgery. He'd broken his leg playing soccer. They were trying to take him to surgery, but they canceled all elective surgeries because they were expecting just tens of thousands of people to just shut down all the hospitals. But then, of course, in the end, hardly anybody was injured because they either got out or they were dead. That's a kind of memory that connects you back to what people are like, but then also into a big event, and helps you to explain that we look back on 9/11 as a big deal, but it wasn't the dramatic, everybody's going to run away from New York and no one's ever going to come back experience that it could have been, and what it really felt like in the terror of those moments. So I don't know. I mean, part of it's just intuition and experience, but you're right that it is a little bit journalistic. And I'll go back to mention something that I've often talked about, but it's why I love Shelby Foote as a historian. Now, is he a historian that all the people who wrote those books on Justin's shelves are going to respect? No. So why are more people reading him than read others? Well, it's because he comes to the discipline of history as a novelist. Mm-hmm. Now, he can run into some of the problems that, Kevin, you're talking about in there. How do you imagine these different things? But the main, you know, these different details, but the main thing he gets right is that he understands that life is lived in the moment with the experience of contingency. You don't know how it's going to turn out. The death of history writing is writing as if we already know that's how it's going to go. That's why people don't like history, because of course we know what happened. The Titanic sank. No, you have to go back and experience what it was like to the shock of the Titanic. Shelby Foote takes you into the mind and says, like a novelist would, like, what were you anticipating? What were you thinking? How were you feeling about this? What was the experience of not knowing how Pickett's charge was going to go? As opposed to, well, Lee is so stupid, why would he ever have ordered that charge? No. What was the experience of thinking you could never fail, and then having failure, and then all of a sudden thinking, we might have lost everything right now? That's, I think, what turns good writing into truly great writing, is an ability to engage the reader when they can put themselves into the story and they can start to relate to it emotionally. I'm not that good at doing that, but I make my little attempts when I can.
Justin, do you have other thoughts from your own experience or the books you've read, either mistakes, or as Collins mentioned a couple, or things like this 1861 book that the good authors, the great authors, do really well?
Well, I think, like, just to reiterate a point that you guys made, I think whenever you're writing and there's any sort of imagination, it has to be rooted in reality. You can't divine somebody's thoughts without saying perhaps they were thinking this. You have to go back and do your historical research of what the weather was like that day. I think a thing that I would want to come back to, because probably most listeners are not saying, I love LBE and I'm doing a big narrative historical project, so this is, you know, a great overlap of my interest. I think the bigger thing is, you know, just how do you write well in general? And you may not have aspirations to be a novelist. You may not have aspirations to write a nonfiction book, but I think everybody should seek to become a better writer, whether you're writing an email or whether you are writing in your journal. And I think it starts with just a rigorous commitment to clarity. And the three of us read a lot, and we read a lot that is not great. And when it's not great, often it's not clear. Just what are you trying to say? Have a purpose, say it clearly, and move on. There's kind of a cliche in the writing business. I think it was Robert Michener said, I'm not a great writer, but I'm a really good rewriter, reviser. There's very few people that write perfect prose. But they go back and they rework it. They listen to how it sounds and not just what it looks like. That was one of C.S. Lewis's advice. Write not just for the eye, but write for the ear. You know, read aloud what you've written. Get critical feedback. Seek to tell the truth. Seek to write in such a way that it's beautiful, although it needs to be clear before it's beautiful. You know, learn the fundamentals before you try to do the trick shots. You know, everybody loves the trick shots, mm-hmm. but, you know, Steph Curry needed to learn how to dribble a basketball before he could do fancy moves with the basketball. And the same with writing. I think as you get into writing, oftentimes we realize no matter what your education was like, most of us are not experts in English grammar. So you can go back as an adult and get a Chicago Guide to Punctuation and Grammar, and you know, education's wasted on the young. We, when we're more mature, can go back and see things. So those are just, you know, lots of quick rapid fire thoughts, but it really is worth trying to become a better writer, no matter what your vocation. And you can't do it without reading, and reading in such a way that you're trying to figure out, why is this boring? Why is this unclear? Why is this compelling? Why does this stick with me? Why does this give me an emotional response? Why does this illumine the ways in which I was thinking? So the, you know, in some ways, like the way in which LeBron James watches a basketball game is different than we do. We just, oh, that's amazing, the shot went in. He's seeing things develop and he's analyzing why a certain play worked or why it didn't work. So I think to be an active, to be a good writer, you have to be an active writer. You have to write a lot and you have to be an active reader as well.
Yeah, let me just, as we bring this to a close and think about some practical points. Like you said, most people aren't there writing a novel or writing a biography, but they're writing. And just to piggyback on that, Colin, I think, because I've thought about this a lot and I don't know the answer, because I read students' papers, love you students out there, a whole lot of people cannot write. Yeah. Yeah. And it's not just, you know, MDiv students. You talk to any doctoral supervisor. Talk to most doctoral supervisors, they probably can't write. Writing is a superpower, to use that cliche. Why is C.S. Lewis still read? Why will people be reading him in 100 years? Yes, he was a very incisive, insightful thinker, but he could write. He said something in a resting way. I've had my students before just look at that famous paragraph from Mere Christianity and the little paragraph there, liar, lunatic, or lord, and a poached egg, are you a madman? You know, and you can just look phrase by phrase how he did things in a way that varied sentence length, that had arresting metaphors. Now, those are some of the trick shots that come, you know, intuitively as you do it. But you're never going to get better if you don't read a lot and you don't write a lot. One of the other things I say is, you're already writing. So the things that you are writing, try to do it well. Maybe, you know, my kids will tell me that texting doesn't count. Okay, maybe that doesn't. Maybe, you know, they will say, Dad, you use punctuation in your text. It makes me feel like you're mad at me.
Maybe not just exclamation points either.
So I understand there's a shorthand way of doing some of that. Maybe that's okay. But an email. I have never gotten a poorly written email from John Piper. Now, he's maybe an extreme in that. He's just, I mean, not only not poorly written, but think, oh, that was really well said and well crafted and thought through. And if you have to write something, and we all do, try to write it well. And then your point, Justin, about rewriting, maybe the single most important thing somebody could do to take their writing from bad to passable or from passable to pretty good is to have a first draft and not make it your last draft and read it out loud. Read it out loud. Actually say the words out loud. I think everything I've written that gets published at some point, and maybe I'm saying it in my head, but I'm reading it out loud. And even when I think something is good, it's amazing the discipline of reading it out loud. I realize, oh, that didn't make sense, or those words didn't need to be there. Cut, 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 you know, murder your darlings, cut words out. But it's obvious to me when students hand in papers, you did not edit this. You ran out of time because you're making me do all the work because you didn't use quite the right preposition, you didn't use quite the right verb, you didn't put things together. And if you would have read it out loud to yourself, you probably would have caught 70% of this. Colin, you have any? I mean, you not only write, but you edit. So does Justin. But you do a lot of editing. What are the key pieces of advice that you give to help people just be passable or pretty good writers?
Well, writing is teaching, and I think that's what you're getting out right there. And if you're going to be teaching, you need to have something to say. So a lot of it is about being the kind of person who has something that needs to be said. If you don't, there's no amount of good writing that's going to make it passable in there. As you mentioned that, Kevin, I'm thinking about 25 years effectively of editing, and I'm realizing it's pretty much always the same things. It's almost always organization. People don't know where they're going. It's just there's no clear logical progression, and then there are no effective transitions. Those are the two major issues. And then what you have to do if you end up in a situation where things are just out of control, what I end up doing is I'll just cut the thing arbitrarily in some ways in half and just see what's left. It's a way of trying to kind of take a meat cleaver to the problem of organization and to find out, can you create some simplicity that allows people to logically go with you? But I'm thinking back to a sermon that I preached earlier this year at a church in Atlanta. And after I preached the first message, my wife said, "You said a lot of good things, but people couldn't really track where you were going." So then I went through and I set people up. I said, "Here's where I'm going." And then I delineated a couple of my points in there. And then when I came back, the pastor, who's a good friend, said, "Wow, that was much better the second time around." I hadn't talked to him about what I was going to do. So it was much better the second time around. It was because there was clear organization and I told people where I was going. So if you do those two things, clear organization, tell people how you're going to get there. Those handholds, they might seem a little pedantic to a more advanced writer who might not need them. C.S. Lewis probably didn't need them in the same way. But for other writers, they're very simple. It's also why you see an epidemic of listicles. Mm-hmm. It's because list writing is tailor-made organization. You don't have to worry about transitions. You don't have to worry about organization. People can easily browse you and kind of skim you to go through that. So that's a kind of a quick and dirty way to be able to achieve better writing if you're struggling with that, is just use things like lists and focus on your organization clarity.
Yeah, that's good. That's really good. Sometimes I've given people the task of say, okay, sit down, take 15, 20 minutes. I want you to write out how you became a Christian. Just go ahead and do that. Or how did you get to live where you are now? And it's amazing, people who really struggle at writing, they won't all of a sudden become C.S. Lewis, but they can churn that out. Why? Two things. One, they intimately know their subject matter. It's their own life. And two, you've given them, as you just said, a narrative arc. You've given them there's a progression to it. You're talking about how I went from not being a Christian to a Christian, or how I came from being born to now being in this particular church. And people can usually, they might still struggle, but I was born here, my parents did this, I went to school. It may not be particularly fancy, but it's clear, it's organized. And so it just helps, I want people to see part of what you said, Colin, makes bad writing is you don't really know what you want to say. I think C.S. Lewis said something to the effect of, you know, great writing is really two things. Knowing exactly what you want to say and then saying it very clearly. It might say a third thing, you have something important or interesting to say. Justin, any last words for us?
Yeah, one last bit of counsel is if you're serious about the task of writing, read some books on writing. You don't need to read 50 books, but you know, pick up something like Writing Tools by Roy Peter Clark or Helen Sword's The Writer's Diet. And not every book on writing is necessarily great, but reading about writing by somebody who knows how to write is just going to be a good discipline. Will make you more self-conscious of what you're doing and how to do it. And yeah, here I've got the exact Lewis quote for you here too. The way for a person to develop a style is to know exactly what he wants to say and to be sure he is saying exactly that. Mm-hmm. The reader, we must remember, doesn't start by knowing what we mean. If our words are ambiguous, our meaning will escape him. And then he has a great word picture here. I sometimes think that writing is like driving sheep down a road. If there is any gate open to the left or the right, the reader will most certainly go into it. So that's that, you know, where I think we're all three hitting that same drum of be clear, be clear, be clear. Know where you want to go. Take the reader there. You know, you have to read aloud. You have to do a lot of reading. And may the Lord help us all to be better writers.
And with that, we bring Life and Books and Everything and Writing and Olympics to a close. So Colin and Justin, thank you for being here. Was going to ask you even more things about your summers, but glad to have you all back. Appreciate you and grateful for our listeners as well. Thank you for listening to LBE, Ministry of Clearly Reformed. You can get episodes like this, other resources at clearlyreformed.org. So until next time, glorify God, enjoy Him forever, and read a good book.